Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. By the way, we will be here live tomorrow, Thanksgiving morning, and you are our only invited guests, so please do come. I'll have lots of questions, and you can bring answers, and we'll talk and be together. We're working up some games to play to have some fun and relieve our Thanksgiving morning anxieties while you cook or travel or just think. So let's be together on The Brian Lehrer Show live on Thanksgiving morning beginning at 10 o'clock tomorrow. And right now, Andrew Bacevich. He's a retired professor of international relations at Boston University and a 23-year veteran of the U.S. Army. His latest book, America's War for the Greater Middle East, is a detailed analysis of the last 3.5 decades of U.S. involvement in the region, a look back at how we arrived at our present situation, and what it will take to move forward in the new world geopolitics. Andrew Bacevich, welcome back to WNYC. Hi.
Thanks very much for having me on.
So it's hard to find two people that sound more different in rhetoric and style than President Obama and President-elect Trump. While it may still be too early, given Trump's lack of clear policy, the two men seem to share one of the hallmarks of previous U.S. administrations, a belief that U.S. military intervention can produce the kind of stability we saw in post-war Europe. I'm just curious to start here from your perspective. After being involved in this for so long and writing this history book, after so many failures or incomplete successes, why are they convinced of such an outcome?
Well, I think that there's great reluctance within the foreign policy establishment and more specifically within the military to acknowledge the extent of our failure. There's a tendency to focus on tactical successes, and we have had some. And to ignore the political results achieved through American interventions, large and small. You know, if the idea is spread democracy, promote women's rights, bring about stability, we just haven't achieved those things, as indeed Donald Trump himself has forthrightly acknowledged.
And made it a campaign platform. But when we invaded Afghanistan in 2001 and later Iraq in 2003, we were fighting under the auspices of defending the United States from perceived existential threats and under a banner of liberation from authoritarianism. 15 years later, the conflict has expanded exponentially, while the reason for propagating it is less clear than ever. What is America's war for in the greater Middle East? What are we fighting for?
Make a very good point, because if you go back to the beginning of the story, and my story begins in 1980 with the promulgation of the Carter Doctrine, at that point of initiation, it was a war for oil. The conviction in 1980 was that the American way of life was dependent upon us having access to Persian Gulf oil, and that's what led Jimmy Carter to initiate what has become a very long military commitment. Fast forward to 2016, guess what? The American way of life is not dependent upon Persian Gulf oil, and whether or not our reliance on fossil fuels is a good thing, there are plenty of fossil fuels in the Western Hemisphere. So your question, what's it really about? I think it has come to be about, in a sense, American exceptionalism. We are a people who insist that we should be immune from the sort of limits and limitations that apply to other countries. We should be able to impose our will where we seek to do so. And the reality is that the effort to impose our will on the greater Middle East by relying on American military power simply hasn't worked. And I think people in Washington especially, but I think also the general public, is exceedingly reluctant to acknowledge the reality of our failure, because that failure will, in essence, amount to an abrogation of American exceptionalism.
It's so interesting that oil is starting to fall off the table as a motivator for U.S. intervention in the Middle East when it was so central. And in the first Gulf War, I remember when President George H.W. Bush and his Secretary of State, James Baker, really argued that a war for oil was defensible after Iraq invaded Kuwait because the relatively free flow of the world's oil supply on, you know, on markets was at stake and shouldn't be dominated by somebody with the willingness to just march his military around the Persian Gulf like Saddam Hussein seemed to be willing to. So they were really making a war for oil is a legitimate reason for war case back in 1990 that we never hear anymore.
I think you're making a very important point. It is striking the extent to which the rationale for continued military action has diverged from oil. And now the focus is, I guess nominally, we're engaged in some kind of a war against terrorism, whatever that means. I think increasingly there's a recognition that the sources of disorder that afflicts the world, really, the terrorism itself is not a sufficient explanation for what is a deep-seated set of conflicts that relate to sectarian identity, ethnicity, history, and to acknowledge that complexity, of course, again, leaves you scratching your head with how we could possibly imagine at this stage of the game that U.S. forces can fix things.
And how about altruism or democracy as motivators? You write about President H.W. Bush's altruistic effort to aid famine-afflicted Somalis, which ultimately ended in disaster in Mogadishu in 1994, and to President Clinton, seemingly regardless of the intention of U.S. involvement, the troops were still seen as occupying infidels by many. Fast forward to President Obama's hesitation toward heavy involvement in the Syrian conflict. He's criticized on the right for not reacting to the red lines crossed by Assad, and on the left for not doing more militarily to aid the humanitarian crisis. So, and of course, President George W. Bush tried to insert a democracy agenda in our invasion of Iraq, which, again, you don't hear anymore.
Well, I mean, I hope I don't come across as unduly cynical, but my guess is that when we've got five or six people sitting around the Oval Office advising the president on who to bomb next, I really doubt that humanitarian considerations figure in a large way in the conversation. It is true.
But maybe that is too cynical, because that's part of the concept of American exceptionalism, isn't it? It's not just U.S. power. It's that the U.S. has something particular to offer the world, and through the American exceptionalism lens, our military interventions are often seen as in the interest of those who are invading.
Well, I think many Americans, average citizens, want to believe that, and indeed the humanitarian concerns expressed by citizens that are continually reflected in our reporting. I think those are genuine and they are authentic, but I think they're also, in a sense, not sufficiently thoughtful. I mean, to the extent that we as Americans believe that we have a responsibility to the people of Syria, and I think that you can make that argument. And it seems to me that the next question should be, well, what's the best way for us to acquit that responsibility, to address it? And I don't believe that dropping bombs does much to help them. I mean, if we really care about the dispossessed people of Syria, then one would think that we would have a far more generous refugee policy than we in fact have. It is astonishing when you think about it that the government of Germany has done far more and done things far more effectively to respond to the plight of Syrian refugees than any other country in the world, to include the United States, because they opened their borders and they provided sanctuary to people who were at risk.
But a country does need to defend itself. So supporters of Trump and his America First policy would argue maybe this makes sense if the wars for oil of the past were illegitimate and the wars for democracy were too pie in the sky and resulted in much more destruction than benefit. If ISIS has declared war on the West, including the United States, then we have a responsibility to our people for the government to go narrowly after ISIS, but not do nothing.
I agree. We should not do nothing. But we also should realistically appraise the threat posed by ISIS to the United States of America. And it seems to me that there's been an incredible amount of scaremongering in that regard. ISIS consists of, 25,000 fighters? They've got no air force. They have virtually no heavy weapons. They've got no navy. They've got no weapons of mass destruction. They've got a very limited resource base. They've got virtually no allies. I'm not trying to say that they are of no consequence, but we're not talking about the Wehrmacht here. So, yes, we should defend ourselves. The question is, does defending ourselves from ISIS require us to continue a set of military interventions in the Islamic world that to date have tended to yield negative consequences, to make things worse? I mean, isn't it time for those who think about policy to consider whether or not there may be alternatives to the continuation of war that may provide for the security and well-being of the United States and actually lead to some outcome in the region other than simply the further perpetuation of more war?
Like what, for example? Because the generals, I think most of the generals today would argue you can't, or just even, I shouldn't put it on the generals, policymakers would argue you really can't let ISIS establish a world capital in Raqqa or take Mosul and run it as, the ISIS capital of Iraq.
Brian, the way you frame the problem is, I guess either the United States has to be at war, or I guess that means that the United States just walks away from this problem and ignores it. And I reject the notion that those are the only two choices. And I would argue strongly that although ISIS does not represent an existential threat to the United States of America, it does represent an existential threat to several nations in that region: Iraq, Iran, Saudi Arabia, Turkey. In other words, it's their problem. And our policy should be one to encourage them to own that problem and to collaborate with one another in order to address that problem. And you might say to me, oh, come on. How can a majority Shiite country collaborate with a majority Sunni country? How can Persians collaborate with Arabs? And I would say that history suggests that when there is a common threat, that nations are able to set aside their differences in order to address that common threat. And World War II, of course, offers the classic example of that kind of a collaboration. So there is a military solution to this problem of ISIS, a military solution to the problem of radical Islamism. But the military solution needs to be one that is imposed by nations in that region, perhaps with some assistance, not imposed by an outside Western power such as the United States.
My guest is Andrew Bacevich, International Relations Professor Emeritus at Boston University, 23-year veteran of the U.S. Army. His latest book is America's War for the Greater Middle East. And Matt in East Northport, you're on WNYC with Andrew Bacevich. Hello.
Hello. I have the most naive question in the world. Is the United States capable of altruism in foreign policy? Even when we talked about Syria, the language was punishing Assad, not defending civilians, for example, defending humanitarian corridors or sanctuaries. This was something the international community failed to do in Bosnia. And President Clinton also expressed regret of not doing anything in Rwanda. So are there any cases where the United States can act where there's no oil, there's no strategic interest, just altruism?
As the policeman of the world, Andrew.
Well, I tend to look for guidance in these matters to Reinhold Niebuhr, the famous proponent of Christian realism, who argued that states are incapable of altruistic conduct. That is to say, actions that are informed exclusively by altruistic considerations. I would certainly argue that altruism, humanitarian considerations, can figure on the margins. But I don't believe that the United States or any other major country in history has had altruism as the driving force in its relations with other countries and with the rest of the world.
Matt, thank you very much. So as we run out of time, do you know this General James Mattis or anything about his reputation or likely approach? Who's talked about as a likely defense secretary?
Yeah, I've only met him once, but he certainly has an excellent reputation as a skilled soldier. But whether or not at this stage of the game, the skills and experience of a soldier are the qualities that we want in a defense secretary. I'm doubtful on that score.
He seems to have talked Trump out of torture.
Well, I was just reading that the transcript of the Times interview, and if you look at the entire transcript, it's not quite as definitive as the Times news story was reporting. There was a certain ambivalence about torture, but you know we'll have to wait and see on that.
America's War for the Greater Middle East, the new book by Andrew Bacevich. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. We will go out to North Dakota and get the latest from Standing Rock next. Stay with us.